Hello, welcome to Outdoors in Scotland. This is John Burns. This is my wee podcast for folk who like the outdoors in Scotland, and to be quite honest, pretty well anywhere for that matter. Sometimes you hear about people, characters in the past in mountaineering in particular, and you find out about them as multi-talented people who seem to excel in all kinds of fields. I don't excel in anything, so how they manage all these different skills, I just don't know. But one such man is Jack Longland, who was a very prestigious mountaineer in his day, and an academic and an athlete, and certainly someone I think whose passage through the mountaineering world needed to be recorded. And Mark Lambert has done just that in his book, A Man for All Mountains, the biography of Jack Longland, mountaineer, educator, and broadcaster. So I'm going to introduce Mark now and let him talk about his book. Hello, Mark, how are you?
Very well, thank you, John.
Great, great. Now, you obviously knew Jack Longland very well. I was wondering, where did you get the sort of inspiration to write his biography?
Well, Jack Longland has sort of been a part of my life from the very beginning. My father was a youth employment officer, and Jack was director of education for Derbyshire and therefore was his boss. So, when my dad discovered that Jack had a glittering Cambridge career, a double first with gold medals and a blue, he reasoned he must have been to a pretty good school. So, he asked Jack which school he'd been to. And as a result of that, I got entered for the common entrance exam to the same school, which was King's School down in Worcester. Alas, I did not repeat Jack's academic performance. And when the Longland family came to live in Bakewell, which is where I grew up, I fairly rapidly got to know Vicky, Jack's youngest daughter, a couple of years younger than I.
What sort of age were you about that then, right then?
I would have been about, well, when I got to know Vicky, I would have been about 18. And we climbed together. And when we were a little bit older, when we were both away at university, myself and my brash late teenage mates would often return to Jack Longland's house after we'd had an evening out. Sometimes a little the worse for beer. And we would often find Jack there. He was very receptive to young people. He was very tolerant of our stoutly argued but ill-formed views of the time and was very gently provocative. But what I liked about Jack Longland was even when I came out with particularly sort of brash, bold views, Jack never actually denigrated them. He'd fence gently and turn you around. But what he was very good at was being extremely rude about the pop music of the time. And he could provoke apoplexy amongst us when he denigrated the Rolling Stones.
Well, the Rolling Stones might have got the last laugh there, really.
The reason I eventually wanted to write a biography of his was that a friend of mine was taught by the late Tim Noble, amongst other things, edited the Climbers Club Journal. And Tim and I met one day, and we met in my lounge where I had bookshelves and bookshelves of climbing books. And we talked climbing. And I just mentioned that so much in the history of mountaineering has Jack Longland's name on it, whether it's Alpine, whether it's Everest, whether it's rocks, more or less anywhere in England. And Tim Noble said, "Why don't you write a biography?" And that's when I started, and that was 20 years ago.
Well, these things do take a while, don't they? What were Jack's origins then? Where did he grow up and where did he come from?
He was born in 1905 and he was born in a little village in Worcestershire. His father was a vicar. Jack was the second of five children. His father was not a wealthy man, as vicars weren't, but was very, very keen on making sure that his children had as broad an upbringing as possible. And along with relatives, Jack often would spend weekends in the countryside. He got to learn a fair amount about butterflies, fair about, and he just learnt to love the hills.
Because mountaineering, so he was sort of mountaineering was kind, well, kind of fairly in its infancy during his early days. Is that a reasonable thing to say, do you think?
Well, the golden age of Alpine mountaineering was over, but mountaineering was known to relatively few people. At school, he had a teacher who had a gîte in the Alps, and it was customary in the pre-war days to go on reading parties to beautiful places to read Plato and Catullus and this sort of thing. And Jack went on a couple with this delightful man, and he was every letter that he wrote home told more about the big mountains around him in that part of France, in Canton Vaud.
And but this must have been, let's see, round about the start of the Second World War. Is that, well, he must have been at university then, is that right?
No, he went to, he was born in 1905. He went and ended up at university in 1921,
Ah, yeah,
22.
okay. Maths ain't my strong point.
No.
Okay, so how did the war influence his career? Because he was obviously a young man.
There's not a very great deal of evidence about it. He was at home. He was at home. They were now in Northampton. The war affected a lot of things, of which both he and his family mention only occasionally. I don't have very many letters from that time, but it certainly, by the time the war was over, Jack developed a hatred of war, and he was a very much a pacifist all his life.
Right, so he didn't serve in the Second World War, is that
No,
right?
no.
Okay. Let's go back a bit, because he was, even in college and in university, he was quite an athlete, really, wasn't he?
Well, at school, he played cricket, he played rugby, he was captain of fives, he won lots of prizes in the annual athletics competitions. And when he went to Cambridge, I think from his letters, he really wanted to be a rugby blue.
Okay.
The problem was that at that time, Cambridge had several internationals,
Ah, okay.
both England internationals and Welsh internationals, playing in the backs. And in the freshers match, he got injured. He was on the pitch for about 4 minutes before he
Okay.
received this fairly savage side tackle and crocked his leg, which put him out of anything for several weeks.
Right.
So that chance was gone. And I think that that's probably why he sought somewhere, something that he was likely to get a blue. I'm sure that the pole, well, the pole jump, as it was then called, now called the pole vault,
Right.
I'm sure it interested him. But I think he realized that there were not many people pole vaulting. This would be a jolly good way of becoming Cambridge's best, because you can't go to Cambridge and not come out with the blue.
I'm sure he couldn't, no. And so he got a blue in pole vaulting, which required, I have no doubt, a fair degree of athletic ability. Am I right in thinking he was already climbing, literally climbing Cambridge? He was climbing the buildings at that time. Is that
Oh,
right?
yes. Even when he was still at school, he took his dad out onto the Malvern Hills, which
Right.
are about 9 miles away, in which there are one or two gruesome little quarries, and persuaded his father to belay him. So he must have known, even then, he must have known the rudiments of rope work, even if it was very simple. And he reflects that in retrospect, it was extremely dangerous for both of them.
Oh, right.
But that was while he was still at school. No sooner had he got to Cambridge, of course, than a lot of the talk was of the young man Mallory, who had died on Everest.
Yes.
And he was keen to join the Mountaineering Club. And he went to visit the president of Cambridge Mountaineering Club, which was a chap called Van Norden. And he knocked on his room door, and a voice from on high invited him to come in, a sepulchral voice, come in. And he opened the door to find him. And I think Lawrence Wager bridged across the corridor above the door. And when he related this story to Jim Perrin, Jim said, "What were they doing?" And Jack said, "Oh, nothing sexual." He said, "And if so, they would have been very, very athletic to have achieved anything up there." And that was one of Jack Longland's features. He was often quite saucy, and he made quite risque comments just to gently perturb people, just to see what sort of reaction he got. And I mean, I experienced this a number of times. Some of his conversation was quite near the bone, but used entertaining and gentle.
So then in his mountaineering career, obviously he took part in the 1933 British Mountaineering Expedition to Everest. Tell me a bit about his role in that, because obviously that was a very significant expedition.
Well, by that time, he had already put up a number of significant rock climbs in Great Britain. And that's what most British mountaineers remember him for, his rock climbs. But for Jack, rock climbing was actually secondary. What he
Right.
really enjoyed was the fast, guideless alpine mountaineering.
Okay.
And he made a lot of very fast ascents in the Alps. And certainly by the time Hugh Rutledge was selecting members for the 33 Everest expedition, there's little doubt that Jack Longland, Lawrence Wager, and Wyn Harris were amongst the very best alpine mountaineers of the time. And so he was really selected. It was almost inevitable that he would be selected. But
Okay.
the Everest party of 33 divided itself into two camps. There were the mostly Oxford and Cambridge mountaineers who were tough, fast, fit, and very experienced.
Yeah.
And there were quite a lot of what became known as the bloody soldiery. There were a number of soldiers who were amongst them, who were there partly because they spoke the local language, partly because they had the experience of the local people, and partly because they could organize things. In the event, Jack relates that they didn't organize things very well, that they didn't perform well on the mountain. And he always believed that had the party had less soldiers and more mountaineers, they would have achieved far more success than they did.
Yeah, because it wasn't a particularly successful expedition, was it?
Well, it wasn't actually any more successful than the two that had gone before,
Right.
except it didn't have any deaths. And it was, in some ways, it was a slightly self-satisfied little expedition. They all came back really quite pleased with themselves, but they
Okay.
hadn't actually achieved anything more than 1924. They hadn't got any higher.
No, am I right in thinking they did a lot of mapping of the area? Is that, or is that, have I got that
It
wrong?
wasn't, it, there was some mapping done on that
Right.
expedition, but
Okay.
most of that was done on subsequent ones. Because Jack was fairly vocal when necessary about his misgivings about the way the party had been handled, much though he liked Hugh Rutledge and respected him enormously as a man and as a mountaineer, he didn't think he'd been a firm enough leader. And he wasn't afraid to say so, which
Okay.
made him a number of enemies. And it effectively scotched any chance he ever had of going on another Everest expedition where Rutledge or his supporters were managing it. Now,
Right.
whether he would have been given leave of absence from his job, he was by this time a lecturer in English at Durham, whether he'd have been able to go is a moot point. But for the rest of his life, and I heard him say this, he would
Right.
have loved to have had a second crack at Everest.
Yeah, I mean, I think they were quite political with a small p, those expeditions, weren't
Subsequently, I mean the dogfight about who might lead the next Everest expedition got really quite nasty and very vituperative.
they? So just to go
He
back
stopped.
to the, sorry, just go back to the 1933 expedition. It one famous incident, in, and that is that he led a group of Sherpas to safety. Is that right? Am I, have I got
That's
that right?
right. That was from the highest camp, from Camp Six.
Oh, right. Okay. What sort of height would that be?
That was true. I'll have to check. I think that was about 26,000 feet.
Okay. So very high on the mountain.
It was the highest established camp
Right. Okay.
from which Wager and Wyn Harris were to make their summit attempt.
Right. Okay.
As after they'd established this camp on a rather shaky little sloping ledge on the north face of Everest, the weather conditions cut in. People who now know the north side of Everest, as my mate Graham Hoyland does, know it very well, say that Jack bringing the porters down in a storm wasn't actually, they say, terribly difficult. They're looking at it from the year 2000. In 1933, it wasn't well known that they didn't have the same equipment, they didn't have the same warm clothing that a lot of people, both contemporary and today, regarded as one of the great rescues. There was a lot of luck involved, but there was also an awful lot of good mountaineering judgment.
Well, I believe he brought them down through a blizzard and
Yeah.
brought them down some considerable distance, and they lost, I think, the footprints of the route. So
Oh, they.
I would imagine just simply as a way of finding your way down the mountain in under those conditions would be a pretty massive feat, really.
Many mountaineers would agree with you.
Okay.
I can't really comment because I haven't had that sort of experience. My experiences on the high mountains have nearly always been in rather better conditions than that. It's pretty clear that at the time it was a very significant achievement.
Yeah, I think we often forget that as our understanding of high altitude, as our knowledge has grown, as our equipment has become better, the barriers the huge though they are still now, the barriers that were faced by the early pioneers were absolutely huge compared to what people face these days.
And the psychological barriers. A lot of that was to a large extent unknown. Jack's ability to determine what he was capable of and not capable of, his self-confidence was being stretched to the absolute limit.
Now, one of the things that interests me about Jack is that he seems to have had multiple careers, really. But he must have been quite an erudite person because he was used by the BBC on quite a variety of programs, Round Britain Quiz, Any Questions, the panel game My Word. This is later in life, I presume. Tell us a bit about how he got into that, because it seems a really big leap from being essentially, an academic and administrator or whatever, to going into that, a completely different world, really.
Well, he was a lecturer. He
Right.
was a lecturer in English at the University of Durham. So he did a lot of speech making because he was witty, quick thinking, and had a what many people describe as a very extraordinary memory. He
Right.
was able to speak at very short notice and still be hugely entertaining. He was also able to plan speeches and make them have a very high impact. When he first spoke at such things as the University of Cambridge Mountaineering Club, the CUMC, he tended to speak very fast and rattle stuff off. Now, his father was a vicar, and his father appeared to have a reputation for being able to give a very steady, very measured sermon.
Right,
And
okay.
I think the more the two interacted, I think the more Jack learned to moderate his rapid fire, bouncy speech. And when he was first asked, he was first asked, I think the BBC's first request to him was to give a talk about getting down Everest in a blizzard.
Right, okay.
And both his style and his voice obviously appealed. Many years later, someone, and I can't remember who, was to describe Jack Longman's broadcasting voice as like honey being dripped on cut glass, which is a bit fanciful. But if you've heard any of those, it was crystal clear and he had a very nice tone. So as soon as he started doing any sort of talks with the BBC, smart producers quickly cottoned on.
Well, they do say that the pulpit is one of the greatest stages in the world. So there you go. I think it's, I'm sure that his father's style would have had an influence on him, as you say. Roughly how long did his broadcasting career keep going then?
We started soon after Everest, about 1937, and he started off with, I think, Country Questions was the first.
Ah, okay.
He sometimes chaired and sometimes appeared on Any Questions, which wasn't always quite as politically driven as it is now. There were at least one or two others, and then My Word came along, and with Frank Muir, Nancy Spain, Dilys Powell, they gelled together superbly. And while neither Norton nor Muir have recorded very much about in writing about those programs, what they have said was that they were immense fun and they looked forward to them. And I mean, these were all chaps with very, very nimble minds. I have some of his notes from these
Oh.
programs,
Oh,
and there's
wow, really?
almost nothing written on them. There's just the odd word here and there.
Okay. I mean, to say that he could, if you like, hold his own or so rub soldiers with well, soldiers, soldiers, shoulders with such company actually says quite a lot, really, because those are immensely talented people. I also get the impression that he was a man who had a sort of huge social conscience for people,
Oh,
particularly
yes.
perhaps as less privileged than himself. And
Oh,
that
yes.
seems to have influenced his, if you like, working life
Oh,
throughout.
yes. Well, soon after Everest, interesting chap called John Newsome came to live next door to Jack and his new wife. And John Newsome had set up the Workers' Education Association in Durham because there were something like 60,000 unemployed miners following the economic collapses of the late 1920s. And he persuaded Jack to give one or two lectures to these guys. And Jack Longman very quickly discovered that instead of teaching fine points of Middle English syntax to university graduates who are already possibly overeducated, he was downright more useful teaching minors to read. And he fairly quickly, the kudos of being a university don, which is still what they call them in Durham in the 1930s, could easily be outpaced by his teaching people who needed teaching.
Right.
And he enjoyed it very much so that at least at one time he was doing a full day's lecturing, which in Durham in those days probably involved three or four lectures a day, not like your modern day university lectures who give one or two a week. And then he would be writing those in the morning, and then he would be getting on the bus and going out to some miners' club or some welfare club out in the sticks to give a 1.5 hour or 2 hour lecture about literature or about writing, reading and writing to miners. And he was capable of immensely hard work.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it. I'd say he sounds to have been someone who respected people across all classes and all ability ranges. Is that true?
Oh, yes. When much of his early climbing was done with the Oxford and Cambridge boys, that was inevitable in the 1920s. They were the ones who got the leisure time and the ability to
Oh,
spend
yes,
time in the
exactly.
mountains. But when he started climbing with folks like Alf Bridge, who was a steeplejack, and with A.B. Hargreaves, who was a accountant, both northerners, rough, tough northerners, he discovered not only that they were expert climbers, which I think some of the Oxford and Cambridge boys hadn't actually realized that there were other high-quality mountaineers elsewhere in the country who didn't have that background.
I can
And he
imagine.
discovered that they were delightful company. And in fact, for much of, I mean, he spent a lot of his climbing life climbing with people who were not Oxford and Cambridge.
So he was, and in some ways ahead of his time, really.
Well, I mean, he was a socialist through and through.
That comes across quite strongly. Of all his achievements, and they are many, what do you think perhaps he would mostly have been proud of?
I think he would have been proud of setting up Whitehall. Whitehall's the local authority, that's Derbyshire Education Authority's outdoor pursuit centre outside Buxton. When he became Director of Education for Dorset, there was a local institution which had been set up, interestingly, by the man John Newsome, who'd introduced him to the WEA up in Durham. John Newsome was Director of Education down there, and he'd set up an establishment called Carey Camp, which was basically like a sort of scout camp where kids from school did all sorts of things. They did hill walking, they had all sorts of competitions, they pitched tents, they did their own cooking, they went swimming, they did canoeing. And it was a sort of early version of a local education authority outdoor pursuit centre. Now, I can't find any evidence that Jack actually started that. I believe it was John Newsome that started that. But Jack was in there straight away, obviously loved it. And when he was appointed, because he was deputy director in Dorset, when he was appointed director in Derbyshire, there was a building outside Buxton was up for sale, and he jumped at it and set it up. In many ways, he has been responsible for untold hours of sodden adolescent misery on the hill, as well as a great deal of joy.
Well, that's right, but it's those sodden hours of misery that we all look back to with great happiness, isn't it?
Oh, Arnie.
Without it, and often which shape our lives beyond for the years to come, you know? So he sounds a really fascinating guy, yeah?
Mean, when I first met him, he was my dad's boss, double first from Cambridge,
Right.
eminent intellectual, and I was a late teenager. I mean, I was overawed by the man, but very rapidly discovered that he had a way of at least understanding youngsters and getting on with them, at least getting on with Vicky's friends, even when we were fairly drunk. I mean, so much so, a number of people invited him to become headmaster. He was invited to become headmaster of King's School in Worcester.
Right.
He was invited to become headmaster of Winchester.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like we've just sort of skimmed through your book, really. But that's perhaps inevitable when you're covering a man of so many aspects as Jack Longland. Now, am I right in thinking that you've got a book launch coming up fairly soon?
I have. The first of them will be at Outside, which is a gear shop, basically
Right.
a
Okay.
big mountaineering gear supply, which is in Hathersage. That will be on Thursday, the 10th of September. It'll cost you a fiver to get in, refreshments, and I'm pretty sure there's a bar. I give something like 15 minutes talk about Jack Longland. Then people ask me questions about Jack Longland, and then hundreds and hundreds of them queue up to pay a lot of money for copies of his book.
Okay, at least that's the plan.
That's the plan. And there's another one coming up at the National Mountain Centre at the Plasy Brenin down in North Wales. And we're hoping to get one at the Alpine Club because Jack was
Great.
president of the Alpine Club at one stage.
Great, great. That's right. And I believe that you're going to try and hopefully get some of his BBC recordings to play. Because
I'm going to try and find, there must be some.
there must be
I'm
some.
going
Yeah,
to try and find them.
but I really hope you do. And certainly, that might be something I could maybe nick a chunk for this podcast if it's not wreathed in copyright, as I
Right.
suspect it finds it.
And between you and me and however many other gateposts will be reading your podcast, I'm actually thinking I might put Jack's name forward for the Radio 4 programme Great Lives.
It's a good idea. Yeah, you must. That's a really good idea. Brilliant.
And we could then incorporate into that programme some observations from his three surviving children, all of whom are immensely proud of their dad, and Dennis, if Dennis is up to it.
Dennis Gray. Yeah.
And
Absolutely. Absolutely.
alas, an awful lot of the people who knew Jack well have died.
Yeah, but it's important to catch the thoughts of the
So I think
people.
it's worth catching them, and it might be nice to get some of their observations actually recorded.
It sounds a brilliant idea, and I'm sure if BBC got any sense to jump at that, you know. And if they don't, I will. How's
Oh, excellent. Good.
that?
Good.
That sounds a good idea. Listen, we're virtually out of time. It's been fascinating listening to you, and it's a brilliant book, and really hope that you go on to really sort of, I suppose, establish the memory of Jack Longdon and what he achieved.
Well, the more I found out about him, the more I admired the man.
Well, you can't say better than that, really.
And I'm actually very proud that I knew
I think, you've achieved quite a lot in producing this incredible record of his
him.
achievements. 20 years' work. That.
Well, there's something of a story behind this in a way. When I took my proposition to John Barton at VP, who are the publishers, he was a bit skeptical because he'd heard of Jack Longdon, but he'd never heard of me. And I said, look, I've written this book and it runs to 460,000 words. And suddenly there was frost in the air.
Yeah, better
And I
well.
said, but I've realized my mates have all told me that this is just unpublishable. So between them and me, we've whittled it down to 170,000. And he relaxed a little bit. Then he said, how many do you think we might produce? Well, I knew the story of a mountaineer who I won't name, but who of whom I'd never heard, and almost unknown, who'd asked VP to write his autobiography. And of the 3,000 copies that he had demanded, most of them have ended up in his garage some years after it was published. So I knew about this. So I said to John Barton, well, perhaps 250? And his shoulders relaxed. And a smile came over his face, and it was clear we were going to do business.
Well, that's great. That's great to hear from that. Thanks very much. And
And thank you for your time.